Welcome to the Plant Grow Reap podcast.
Welcome back to Plant Grow Reap. I'm Jasmine, and today we are very lucky to be joined by Ruth Kent, the founder and director of Sunrise Well. So Ruth is a specialist in workplace wellbeing, consulting, training and coaching. She believes everyone deserves to flourish at work and in life, and I'm so excited to dive into a topic we're very, very aligned on. So welcome, Ruth.
Thank you.
So first off, can you tell us about your background and journey in this industry? Sort of what led you to start Sunrise Well and, you know, what gaps did you see available at the time?
Okay, yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. So I guess to start with my background, when I started uni, I went into psychology. And I was sort of halfway through the course and I realized I don't really want to be a psychologist, but I finished off the degree. Towards the end of the degree, I found what I hadn't known before, which was a subject called health sociology. So it was basically looking at population health. And from there, I got really fascinated at the sort of that interplay of psychological principles on human behavior and human health. And so I went on to study in like a postgraduate diploma in public health. And while I was doing that, so that was sort of looking at, you know, population health strategies, health promotion, sociocultural aspects when we look at illness, disease prevention and health promotion, epidemiology and all those sorts of things. And while I was doing that, I was teaching English as a second language. So I spent a lot of time traveled, lived overseas, lived in South Korea, Japan, Brazil, came back and lived in Australia and really enjoyed that. Did a little bit of work in the government as well, doing some graduate program at the Department of Health and Aging. And I went back to teaching after the graduate program because I really enjoyed the interaction of working with people. I realized when I was working in the government, I kind of realized I loved that work, but I felt too distanced from people in many ways. So I like to see that immediate impact when I'm working with people. And so I went back to teaching for a little bit, but I wasn't completely satisfied. And I was definitely sort of climbing up the teaching ladder. I was teaching diploma students in health science at university, or they were moving into the University of Technology in Sydney, UTS. And around that time, I was talking to my husband about, well, what do I do? You know, where do I go? Do I sort of keep pushing and move into lecturing and become a professor? And, you know, is that my path? But I wasn't really inspired enough to do that. And, you know, at that time when I was talking to him, he said, well, why don't you do something yourself? So by that time, I guess I had accumulated my, you know, my public health and the psychology and a couple of other trainings. So by that time, I'd started health coach training, meditation teacher training, yoga teacher training. And I thought to myself, like, let's just bring it all together and look at how I can do some kind of health promotion activities using, you know, these skills. And it kind of went from there. I immediately fell into working with corporates. Part of it was, you know, I didn't see myself in the community-based model, I guess, of delivering that kind of work. And also I think just the fact that I'd had by that time like 14, 15, maybe 16 years of, maybe around 14 years of experience in teaching and facilitation and working with groups, it sort of was a natural fit to go into working in that model of delivering, continuing to deliver and facilitate. So that's sort of where it began with me delivering workshops. What I've found is that began around 2013, 2014. What I've found is that over this time, the concept of wellness and well-being and health and all this at work has changed so much. Yes. And so, in terms of gaps, I think that the entire industry has just been maturing and evolving all this time. So it's become, you know, the conversation has become less about is this a perk that we're adding on to, you know, the job ad that we can let people know that they can get massages at once a month, or, you know, fruit bowls and all that. And it's becoming more like, you know, how is this actually impacting performance? And it does, you know, we're still talking about retention, and we're talking about how can we keep people in the job, but also what kind of experience are they having in the job, and are we actually supporting them with this or not? So it's been a really interesting conversation. Now at this point, I've managed to, in many different lucky ways, I guess, the people that I've been able to work with nowadays in the last couple of years, or in the last year or so especially, I've been working with really big organizations like Medibank. So I partner with Medibank to deliver to many large organizations. And I also get to be involved in other programs. So I'm supporting a pain management community-based clinical model. So I do sleep consulting there, and sleep education for that particular organization, and, you know, delivery to organizations in terms of their training needs. So yeah, it's quite varied, and it really depends on what's needed. But yeah, that's been the journey so far. And like I said, this last year or so coming into partnership with Medibank is kind of a real highlight for me, that I'm able to work with the caliber of organizations that are really at that level of wanting to invest in their people. And so, yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, because wellness, as you said, it's completely different now. You know, even from when I was a kid, it was just like, oh, yeah, it's, you know, something that was always in the back of your mind. But now, sort of having, you know, been at a few different employers, definitely it is at the forefront, and it's, you know, it's about how can we make sure that when our team members are here, they're happy to be here, you know, especially after, you know, COVID, even though it was so long ago, you know, getting people into the office, making the office a nice place for them. And, you know, you've got, you know, we spend most of our, you know, week at work. So, you know, it's important to have it be a place that we want to be. And yeah, wellness has definitely changed. I mean, I never got the massages. I was always giving my massages away for free at my previous employer. But no, everyone loved it. It was like, oh, thank God she's in. It's like the best, and it's like all the tension. And afterwards it just changes the whole mood of the office. And, you know, we had like meditation hour and all that sort of stuff, which was good fun. So it's definitely changed. And it's very interesting to see where it will be sort of in the next few years with all the regulations coming out. I think it'll be very interesting.
Yeah. I think when we think about it, like, we can consider, I think, like I said, well-being in the last decade or so was really considered this fluffy thing. And now there's a sort of an understanding, well, actually we need to develop this as a capability, and maybe it's not as fluffy as we thought it was. So, you know, aside from that sort of aspect where we get, you know, people coming in and doing massages and things, what are we doing with the, you know, like you said, the regulations, the psychosocial risk? And we are looking at things like, well, we're looking at how do we balance workload? How do we look at responsibilities within the role? And then fatigue management, for example, like if we have people coming in who are getting exhausted, are they being exhausted from the workload? Do we need to have a conversation around that? Or do we need to help support them to understand, you know, what's happening at home and how they can help manage their sleep? So that whole thing, that's been another side of well-being that's been an interesting, like, thing to observe and be a part of, is the way it's swung all the way over. So it's kind of swung over to compliance the last year or two, and that's all that we talk about is, you know, psychosocial risk and how can we manage it, which is 100% necessary, right? But at the same time, there's the individual responsibility. Yeah. So that pendulum's kind of coming back to the middle. My role, you know, as far as I've found in this particular era that we're in, is how can I help organizations to be proactive in their approach? You know, let's be proactive, let's strengthen the teams, let's help develop their capabilities, and, you know, fingers crossed, hopefully that will help later down the track when the risks start to emerge, or you know, in order to keep a track of what risks could be coming up. So we're developing the psychological safety to have conversations and, you know, so it's, yeah, I feel as though it's still evolving.
Yes.
And we're just working along with it.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting because, as you said, the observations, and one thing that I've noticed is, you know, I'm a very observant person. I always sort of sit back and I listen, and it's like I listen to what people say and how they say it and how they move and sort of all that sort of stuff. And I think it's really interesting because what I've noticed is how personal lives sort of are spilling over into work lives and how it's affecting, and then trying to manage that. But then there is that line of where do you kind of go, okay, is it actually work related or is it, and then how you sort of go about navigating that, I think becomes, it can be really tricky because it's like it's spilling over into here. So you kind of have to manage the result of it. And, you know, but you then you can't get to the cause of it. And, you know, so it's, I think it's a really interesting thing that's happening at the moment. And it's like, where does that responsibility and accountability lie? Because we, you know, we can only take care of you for the time in which you're in our office and at work, you know. So how can we sort of help you to be better in managing that? That's where I find it really tricky sometimes, because it's like, oh, I know it's not work related, but I know it's coming up as, you know, you may be coming in a little bit later and like, or, you know, leaving a little bit early, or, you know, just being, your desk is all of a sudden messy. It's like, oh, how do we kind of remind people like, hey, this, you know, let's declutter. Yeah. Like, let's, it's that really interesting thing that I've noticed and observed. And I think it's, yeah, it is, it's like that pendulum. We're talking about all this stuff at work, but then the understanding of sort of how it's affecting as an overall, you sort of do, you have to look at it as everything. And that's why I always say it's life balance. It's not work life balance. It's life balance. You have to actually look at everything in order to be able to make everything better. You know, it's, you know, by focusing on work and separating it from your personal life, it's like, yeah, you can do that, but you can just have balance all around. And when you do that, it's like, well, you can come in on time and leave on time and do your work, but then you've still got that hecticness sort of outside of it. And so, yeah, exactly. It's really interesting sort of what's happening in the space and the conversations that are surrounding it. So, yeah, it's definitely an interesting time in wellness for sure.
Yeah. And I think like the only way to really know, you know, there's so many things tied up in this, but first of all, we've got this concept of unconscious bias where we're making assumptions, you know, where we're looking at someone and the way they're dressed or the way that they're acting, you know, and the way that all the things that they're bringing, and we're making assumptions to say, well, it's probably this or it's probably that, you know, and or maybe they don't care, or, you know, so we're making assumptions about the person before having any kind of real knowledge about what's going on. So there's that. And then, so that's actually an area that I do a lot of training in, because it's helping people to understand, let's not jump to conclusions about this. Let's not let out, you know, we've got to slow down, take a breath, and figure out, you know, is this a conversation I need to have with this person in order to find out? And then a lot of the leaders and managers and people that I speak with, they're not trained in having these conversations. Yeah. So they're not really trained necessarily to have, like you said, that observational ability to, you know, tune in and pick up on, and even have the time to have these conversations, and then to notice, you know, when you're having a conversation like this and you're asking that question, you know, or letting them know what you're observing, which is, you know, a great way to approach it, not to say you are doing this, but I am observing or I'm noticing this behavior. Then once we do that, is not necessarily that the person is going to divulge all of their information.
Absolutely.
Right.
So yeah.
Have you built up that psychological safety with them to be able to have it?
No, 100%. It's really hard, because I think immediately most people, because we care, we want to fix it and we want to make sure everything's right. And sometimes it's really hard in those moments to go, oh, this person, they don't feel comfortable talking to me, but that's okay. Like, at least, you know, I've just like, hey. And sometimes that first initial like contact is enough for that person to be like, oh, okay, maybe I need to stop and reflect, or maybe they don't, and that's okay, because people will, I'm a very big believer in people will receive things when they're ready to, and, you know, you've just got to help them navigate it, and allowing people, because I always say to this, and this is probably because I'm a yoga teacher and Pilates and all that sort of stuff, I go, like, I have none of the answers you're looking for. But what I can do is I can help, like, I will just sit and listen, and I'm happy to just sit and listen about whatever it may be. You can tell me about your cat. You can tell me about something that you did on the weekend, and that's okay, because sometimes we just need that little bit of a distraction or that little bit of thing to help build that trust, but then also break down that, oh, okay, you know, maybe I can speak to this person. And so when they're coming from a place of, you know, hey, I've noticed this, like, I just want to check, do you need more support in this area? Oh, it's actually being genuine, and it's coming, you know, it's not, I don't have to sort of be like ready to, because sometimes that's what happens and people aren't ready to share, and that's totally okay.
And one of the things that comes, that has come up a lot in response to one of the trainings that I provide, when we talk about this specifically, a lot of people say that they get a lot of, what's the word? They get a lot of reassurance out of knowing that they are not the ones who, they often want to jump in and fix and have a solution. And when we're in a group and we're discussing this, a lot of people realize they find it hard just to listen, and they find it hard to, you know, not want to fix it and find the solution straight away. So not giving that space. Whereas, you know, when we're talking about it, we're talking about, well, yes, if we will get to that point. We will offer them support, of course, but let's just open it up, you know, and just listen.
Yeah.
And people find that often quite hard. We were talking also about pauses, you know, and taking a pause, letting that pause, that silence sit before trying to solve the problem. And all of this is how that safety is created. So, it's really interesting. And I think what's helpful in the trainings is for people to hear other people's experience and go, oh, I thought it was just me. No, it actually, it's you know, the experience of a lot of people who feel uncomfortable having these conversations and not feeling sure about how to navigate them.
I think, you know, as a whole, we're not really taught, you know, what to do when we're uncomfortable and to sit in that discomfort. Because quite often when you're talking to people, it can actually bring things up for you and you go, oh, yeah, oh, you know, and sometimes you'll self-reflect and you go, oh, why am I, it's like, oh, yeah, maybe I need to look at myself. And so it can be really hard to just sit there and just be. And, you know, but I enjoy it so much because there's always those moments that after a while where it's like you go, oh, Now I can see it, because you know more about that person and what they need in that moment, because people will always tell you what you need if you just listen. What they need if you just listen to them. They'll always say, oh, I just need this, but that may not necessarily be what they need. They just, and it's like you can cut through that. And I always think it's such an honor and a privilege when people come to you and just go, oh, I've got all this stuff going on, and, you know, and you just sit there, you're not offering solutions, which can sometimes be really hard because you're like, and it can, you know, get, you can have that inner fight, but it's something that's really nice to sort of just over time, if you can, just sit and just be with a person. I think it's one of the highest honors that you can have as a person, regardless of your relationship with them.
Yeah. And I think just to counter that, on the flip side, is also to make people aware at work that they don't have to be a therapist. You know, that's not their role. So at the same time, like, you're there to listen, you're there to invite that conversation so that you can help them to take those further steps, but you don't have to solve the problem. No. You don't have to act as their therapist. And most importantly, I think within this conversation is, sort of, as you sort of mentioned a little bit earlier, when someone is bringing you this, how are you personally feeling? Like, what are you bringing to the conversation in terms of your own well-being? Are you managing your own well-being? Yeah. Are you getting support that you need? You know, if these conversations aren't right for you, then they shouldn't be, you shouldn't be having them. You know, so figuring out and navigating that plane as well is really, really important. And something that you know, I think as if we're talking about leaders or managers, I think it's that whole put your oxygen mask on first.
Like, yeah, exactly.
You really do need to look after yourself in order to be able to be balanced and regulated. And that's how you're going to have a more coherent conversation anyway. And it's going to come across to the other person. So,
yeah. No, exactly. And I think, you know, as you said, many workplaces now, they're sort of prioritizing well-being. And are you finding that a lot of them don't know where to start? And so, you know, what are some practical, realistic first steps leaders and businesses and owners and managers can take to build the well-being in the office?
Look, I think, yeah, you're right in some ways that they don't know where to start in many ways. Like, obviously, compliance is a regulation compliance and making sure that they're following those processes is, you know, the first step, really, essentially. That should be the minimum. But like I said, I play in the area where people are strengthening their team. So they're going beyond that. So they're not just ticking boxes and being compliant to say, yep, tick, we've done that, moving on. It's more about organizations that see their people as an investment, and really not just the health, but also the well-being, the mental health, the whole picture of you know, what someone presents with. And as you said earlier, that they are a whole person, that they have inside of work and outside of work. They live their lives. So you know, like I said, we do want to start with, you know, making sure that they're ticking those boxes, but we then want to say, well, how can we actually make this preventative? So we're not just, you know, pulling people out. You might have heard the Desmond Tutu quote of, you know, we need to stop pulling people out of the river. We have to go upstream and figure out why they're falling in. Yeah. So, you know, figuring out as much as possible why people are falling in and how can we stop them from falling in, like what life jackets are we giving them? So, you know, and how can we even stop, put up those barriers and put up the fences and help people to learn to swim and all of those things that help people before they even fall in the river. So, yeah, like I said, it really, when it comes down to the actual strategies, I find that it's very much specific to the organization, because I really get that public health lens when I think about this, which is when people come together, you know, we've got a few issues, and this is where well-being hasn't really been able to hit the mark easily, because we've got the person who is creating the program or putting it together, they have their lens on the world and their mm-hmm. methods, their marketing, their processes, what they think should be done. All of this is coming through their own lens and may not actually be fitting for the demographics of the organization. So if you've got a 20-something, 25 to 30-year-old female putting together a well-being program that they think sounds really good and they're marketing it out, and the communications are all based on what they think is the right way to do it, may or may not actually be fitting for the group within the teams who are 40, 50-year-old white male, you know. So just thinking about just those population type of statistics and, you know, not to overgeneralize, but just to understand that when we are communicating a message, like, we really need to think about, well, who's receiving that message? How do they want to receive the message? What's the best methods for those to be transmitted? Because a lot of the time when we talk about ROI on, you know, the investment of well-being, I think these kinds of things have been missed. And so that's something that that's why I say, well, it comes down to the organization. And then we go into the measurement and the data and say, well, what's actually going on? You've got your engagement surveys, you've got your pulse surveys, those are good. But you could also do focus groups, you could do some one-on-ones, and always tying it into, well, what's the vision here? Like, where are we starting? What's our starting base? And then what's the vision going forward? Do we want to you know, do we want to have a focus on becoming the most, you know, well in terms of sleep and rested, or, you know, and how does this tie into the values of the organization? So having leadership on board is so, so important, because they will be driving this. If they're on board and they're demonstrating those values, it moves away from it being that tick the box, or this is like a culture employee type of like attraction strategy. It's more about, well, this is the organization and this is what we live. And I, as the leader, or, you know, the C-suite, we are living these values and we are driving this as much as the people on the ground. And so at the same time, though, you do want the grassroots buy-in. You want the people on the ground to say, well, this is something we want, and it's tailored to what we need. Because, like I said, a lot of those programs are marketed out, and you're wondering why the people on the outside, the margins, are not picking up and joining. Well, maybe it hasn't been shared in the way that makes them interested enough to want to be a part of it. Maybe they don't have a buy-in with that, or, you know, so there's, you know, their affinities are not there. So those are the sort of some of the things I'd say to start with. And depending on the size of the organization, also look at piloting out a program to say, well, okay, first of all, we're getting our data, we're getting our measurements. Like I said, you've got the surveys, but also some of the baseline stuff around absenteeism, presenteeism, perhaps workplace injuries, physical injuries, psychological injuries. You know, put that all together and then give yourself a period of time and say, well, we would like to see changes in X, Y, and Z. You know, perhaps we want to see less absenteeism. We want to get a better result on our survey. So these are sort of the things that we're aiming for. So we're setting some goals, and then we might just pull together one particular group, which may be just one section of the organization. You know, it might be the IT team or the front of office team, and have a talk to them about, all right, let's roll this out with you guys. We'll see how the take up is and see what the interest is and what the results are. And then if it's working, let's roll it out further. So you're not biting off more than you can chew, and you can sort of measure it as you go without too much investment. And, you know, if you've got the people involved and letting them know, then that's even better, because they are going to have more buy-in if they have the input. Yep. So it's more co-designed, you know, you're designing it with them and saying, well, we need your input, so we need to know if this is going to work for you. So those are some of the things, I think. And then a lot of it, so there's been that conversation around, you know, these things like fruit bowls and whatever, they don't work. I would say that they're not working. It's just that you do have to look at the organization as itself and say, well, are we offering flexibility for these people? You know, are we saying one thing, like we value your sleep, but overloading them with work? You know, so if you're putting together a program and you're getting, like I do training in sleep hygiene. So I come in and do some training in sleep hygiene, but then you're piling up, you know, work that they have to do until midnight that night. The contrast is there, you know, it doesn't balance up. And so their message is not coming across. So both of these are effective. So the sleep hygiene education is always going to be effective, but you have to look at how we're setting up the business itself and the processes, you know, in terms of workload, work management, roles and responsibilities and things like that. So, you know, if someone's asking for flexibility and you're able to provide it, why not? You know, if that's going to keep that person in their job and more engaged, then why not? You know, so yeah, those are some of the things I'd be looking at.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and I like that you're sort of talking about looking at it from a holistic point of view of looking at everything. It's not just one thing. So, you know, if you, and I think that's so important, because if you're so focused on one thing and then you're like, well, why isn't this happening? It's like, well, because it's more than just that one thing. Like you said with the fruit bowl, it may appear that it's not working, but it could just look different to what you were expecting. And I think that's always a really interesting concept, is, you know, we do things and we don't necessarily know if they're working or if they're worth it. And it's like, well, have you spoken to people? What's the feedback you're getting? Oh, I don't know, but by the end of the week, all the fruit's gone. So is the fruit bowl not working then? You know, like, what's going on there? Which I think is, I think it's interesting to sort of understand that.
Yeah. I would say like it, those sorts of things. I have had a bit of a bad rap lately, but I would, so there was a big paper that came out of the UK saying all of those things don't work, basically. Meditation apps don't work, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the only thing that works is job design. And absolutely, like if the job is not designed well, it's, you know, it's not going to work. Someone's not going to want to go to work if they are being pushed and overloaded and, you know, or bullied and harassed and all those sorts of things. But on the flip side, these things do work when they are delivered in the right way to the right people at the right time. So we don't have to throw them away. We just have to be more strategic about it and understand that, yeah, there is definitely a place also for any of these things because they can help people not only live well and live better, but potentially have longevity, you know, and a better health span. So they're not going to be turning up sick to work. So I don't understand how anyone could say that doesn't work. If someone walks away with some tools that actually changes the way they're living their lives, it may not have like a 12-month ROI. It may be more like a 10-year ROI where they stay in their job and for an extra 5 years because their health has improved, you know. That's not something you can measure in 12 months. You will see when that person, if they stay with your company, if they're with you instead of retiring at 60 because they have a bad back and they, you know, they're exhausted and they, you know, they've given up basically, they've had enough, or do they have that functionality to work for another 5 or 10 years, which a lot of people who invest in their well-being absolutely can. And we're seeing great examples of that now. So I think taking that bigger picture view and a little bit of perspective on it, I think is really important.
And do you find that, because, you know, I suppose it's very common, you know, we want that instant sort of, I guess, I'm thinking of social media and I'm going, oh, like the dopamine hit, but it's like we sort of want to see the results straight away when we make a change, and that's sort of become an expectation, I think, amongst a lot of people. And so with things like well-being, do you find that people are expecting to see, you know, in a massive shift in 12 months, or do you find that it's, you have to sort of explain like, no, it can actually take up to 10 years. And so the benefits you may see are going to look, you're not going to see them until maybe that person retires or whatever it may be.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think there's two ways to look at it. But the first is let's say you've got Jan in accounts who had nothing to do with breath work before, or you know, had no idea about looking after her sleep. So she actually got addicted to Instagram and was up till 11, you know, and wasn't sleeping well. And then you've got someone coming in and helping them to understand that actually, you know, these are some of the things you can do. Well, she's already going to feel better, right? She's going to come in within, if she's implementing those strategies, she's going to come in and report to you. And you will see, you know, when people are fatigued, for example, there's higher error rates. Their performance on the job is a lot lower. So you may start to see those metrics earlier. And so you can definitely measure those sorts of things earlier. But I guess what we also need to think about is that when we're doing this kind of investment, we do get those short-term benefits, but we also get those really long-term benefits as well. But it's the flip side with compliance as well. Like as long as if you're investing in making sure your job is, the job is flexible for someone, you may have someone who has to do school pickup and they find it really hard to actually do a full-time job if you're having them in the office all the time. But if you're flexible enough to let them work from home, they can go and do school pickup. The grandma can look after the kids while you finish off work in the office when the kids are home. That kind of flexibility comes in, then that person is going to stay, they're going to feel better as well. And stay in their job for longer as well. So it's just understanding that, you will see short-term benefits for any of these things, but also longer-term, any of this investment is going to likely, most of the time, you know, being a bit scientific and not committing fully to saying 100% of the time, but most of the time, people are going to have better results short-term and long-term. And when you see that, you see people having healthier, longer lives. We can never predict, you know, somebody's lifespan, but in general, we can say we would hope that someone who is investing in better sleep, for example, they're able to prevent or have a better chance of preventing dementia. You know, so if dementia is affecting them in their 60s or 70s, we want to try to put that off as long as possible, both for them, of course, and, you know, the burden on the healthcare system and the family system, but also just on at work, you know, the fact that they can keep coming to work and contributing and feeling good about that. So it's a win-win as far as I can see. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times meditation and sort of breath work and that sort of thing. I know that's something that's played a huge role in your life from a young age. Why do you see it as such a core foundation of wellness for you?
So I was lucky enough to learn to meditate about 30 years ago. So I was 15 and my boyfriend at the time was my first serious boyfriend. I spent a lot of time at his house, and his parents lived on a commune in Southeast Queensland in the bush. And, you know, they used to go off and do this funny thing called meditation. And at the time, no one really talked about that. And I think I had really open-minded parents, and, you know, they have always just said, explore the world. You know, there's no limits, just explore and find out and, you know, be curious. And I said, oh, what are they doing, Dad? And, you know, he kind of explained his understanding of it. And I was curious about it. And one day my boyfriend's mother said, do you want to join us on a retreat? They were having a beginner's meditation retreat. And I said, yeah, absolutely. So I spent 3 days in the commune and just learning how to meditate. And I have to say, I think I was just lucky that the teacher was so good and the group of people, whatever the environment was, I didn't struggle at all. I had an amazing time and was hooked from the start. And, you know, so that I have carried with me this whole time as a kind of an anchor. So sometimes, especially in my 20s, I probably dropped the practice for a bit and then come back to it, and it would be my anchor to sort of ground myself again when things got crazy, and I'd be like, what's missing here? And I realize I haven't meditated for a little while. So that's sort of where it all began. And with the work that I'm doing, what I'm increasingly seeing is how much of it comes down to self-awareness. So when you're talking with, whether it's, you know, we were talking earlier about having those conversations and psychological safety, there's a lot of self-awareness that's needed in that. Same for any kind of health and well-being endeavor, really understanding, well, what's my motivation, and picking up on those subtle cues within yourself. That's what really, I think, helps you personally as an individual to make better decisions. Being able to tune in, same for conversations, same for team dynamics, team communication skills, anything that involves any facets that involve humans, I think. The self-awareness piece fits into the emotional intelligence, which is really, really important for your health, but also, like I said, your engagement. So when we look at like Daniel Goleman's idea of emotional intelligence and the concept that he's put forward around self-awareness and self-regulation, meditation is extremely important in both of those, but also social awareness and social engagement, the other pieces of his model. You know, having that self-awareness helps you to have social awareness and helps you to pick up on how you are socially activated. And all of these together connect to empathy. So your ability to be self-aware, and through meditation, you're learning it's not just self-awareness. So when I talk about meditation, it's like awareness of your feelings, your thoughts, your surrounding environment through it. It's also through a gentle, nurturing lens. So it's this idea that you're a human, you're benevolent. You know, there's sort of a benevolent observation that's taking place, understanding and bringing that sort of kindness to yourself first, These are thoughts that I'm having, you know, and then what we tend to do when we're meditating is we're like noticing our thoughts, and then you're like, oh, that's a terrible thought. I'm a terrible person, you know, and so you're catching yourself in those moments and going, huh, am I? Or am I human? You know, is this a human thing to do? And so being able to get that perspective and take the lens of someone who's kind, which is not the way that most people speak to themselves. That's not the narrative in their minds all the time. So if we can do that and apply that gentleness to ourselves first, we're able to then reflect that back out to other people. And that's where that empathy builds, because if I reflect and notice my discomfort, you know, if I'm in a situation where I'm in feeling uncomfortable or feeling unsure or sad or angry or any of these challenging feelings, then I know that other people also experience that, and then I can bring my compassion to them. So this is where I think it can play a really important role in the workplace, because first of all, it's around decision making. So behavior, decision making, health behaviors and health choices. A lot of the time we're punishing ourselves, you know, so not only am I feeling really rotten, but I'm going to go and eat all of this stuff, or I'm going to go have all that coffee, or, you know, or drink really extra glasses of wine. So yep. I'm going to punish myself that way.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or I'm going to look at Jan in accounts and give her this, you know, the evil eye because I'm really annoyed at myself, you know, and I'm not picking up on that because I'm lacking that self-awareness. So instead of, you know, taking the time and the perspective on myself to sort of talk through in my mind, okay, why am I feeling this way? What's triggering me? Can I bring some sense of compassion and soothing to this situation? And then can I approach Jan in accounts and have a conversation, you know, and taking that step back and creating that space? That's where the value lies, because we're able to build real relationships rather than these sort of very reactive, very impulsive behaviors and relationships and communications.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting, because as you were going, like the thought process in our own heads, it's like, yes, no, I know that all too well, because I will often, I do like a 90-minute open-eyed meditation. That's the type of yoga I do, and it's very intense, but I will often get in there and I will see whenever a negative thought comes into my mind, because I'm looking in a mirror, I see how it is on my body and I hate it. I go, oh no, like I can't. Like, what are you doing? Don't do that. And then, so then by the end of it, there is that kindness I show. It's like, oh, I just need to be kinder to myself. And then you're very right. It just changes your out, like what you put out there. And it's something that is, it can be really personal and it can be confronting, but it is just so beneficial on 101 different levels, because I also know that, oh yeah, I'm gonna go eat the food that I can't eat. I'm lactose intolerant. I'm not opposed to when I'm not feeling, it's just like, oh, I'll just have a little bit of cheese, and then it turns into like a massive bit of cheese, and then it's like, I'll just have one glass of wine, and then it turns into a lot of glasses of wine. So yeah. I know that all too well, and I think it's meditation is, and working on your breath is so important. It is your life force. And so it's like, don't forget to breathe. And, you know, the quality of breaths changes things. And, you know, it does. It just 10 minutes, not even, can change your perspective and how you sort of see the world and how you're sort of perceived can change really quickly.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the trainings I do is on stress management. And I talk to the teams about how often when stress is getting overwhelming, we're getting this sort of narrative in our heads, and we're also, you know, we're dealing with a lot. And one of the first things to go is the way that we're coping. So, you know, are we reaching for strategies that help us to cope with sustainability, or are we reaching for the things that are the short-term fixes? And a lot of the time, if we can take that pause, we can notice, well, what's the story going on here? You know, for me to be telling myself that the easiest fix, the quickest fix, because I'm running on this high stress, you know, my cortisol's high and my energy is low and I just need a quick fix. You know, I could go for a walk, I could get a glass of water, but the thing in your mind is the piece of cake or the, you know, and over the long term, you know, obviously that's not going to be the best thing for our health. So, yeah, and so there's that mix of, you know, the stress itself, but also the way we're looking at it. One of the things when you were talking about that earlier, it reminded me of one of the ways that they talk about in meditation, the thoughts that are going past. Because I guess I should say, for anyone who's not sort of fully, you would know this, but who might not be fully up on meditation, is a lot of people talk about it being emptying your mind. But what meditation really is observing your mind. The thoughts can never be emptied out of your mind. Mm-hmm. Your mind will always have thoughts. Yeah. So when you're observing those thoughts, they talk about it being like, you could imagine like a highway of thoughts or a stream. Some people like to imagine a stream with leaves on the stream. And one, when I think of the highway, when we're having thoughts, you might see a yellow car, and then, you know, a minute or two later, you see the same yellow car. And a couple of minutes later, that yellow car comes past again. And over time, you start to think to yourself, well, there's that yellow car again. It just keeps coming past. That yellow car is this specific thought, you know, that you keep coming back to. And so when you practice this again and again, you start to see the same narratives coming up. Mm-hmm. And it's a great way to sort of, first of all, just observe it. I think, you know, when you're beginning with meditation, it's just observing that thought and going, well, there it is again. You know, is this a real thing? Is this a thought? You know, are thoughts actually real? You know, does this actually, is this a truth that I'm looking at as this yellow car goes past? And then, you know, starting to pull it apart a bit and ask yourself, well, why am I doing this to myself? Where is this coming from? Sometimes it's coming from, you know, upbringing and childhood, or mm-hmm. some kind of social, you know, imbibation that we sort of, something's come into us socially, or it's good to have that perspective. And it doesn't mean, I think the other thing I like to say to people is, it doesn't mean that you're going to suddenly stop yourself from doing anything. Yes. And you're going to always present, you know, like, I've been meditating for 30 years and I still snap at my children when I'm, you know, really, when I'm stressed and when I've got a lot going on and when I haven't slept well. My poor little kids are the ones who get, you know, the worst side of me when I'm feeling tired. So I think we have to, again, bring that compassion in and benevolence and say, well, just because you're meditating doesn't mean that your life is going to be perfect. Yeah. There are going to be times where you're not going to be perfect, and that's okay because you're human.
Yes, and I think it's also important to note that you're not going to just become this really zen person and version of yourself. It's, you know, you are still going to have all of those things. And I think, I can't even remember, ages ago, but I sort of think of it, it's like, at what point does a thought become a thought? You know, because it can just exist in your mind. Like, it can just be there. And sometimes that in itself, it's like when meditating, I always, whenever that happens, I go, no, go away. I don't want to think about that, because I know what's going to happen, and taking it, and then the tangent that it goes down. Because as you said, you know, your thought processes from when you're younger, if things happened, you know, and it's like, that's how I sort of stop myself from going into that, I guess, negative place or that place where I don't want to be. It's like, I know if I attach something to this, it will go downhill very quickly. You don't just become a zen person and all of a sudden, you know, start walking like you're on clouds all the time. I think meditation is really important, just to sort of give back to yourself. You know, even if it doesn't have to be a long session. Like I said, I know I do like a 90-minute open-eyed meditation, but it doesn't have to be that. You also mentioned sleep. A lot in terms of sort of working on sleep. How within your business has that sort of evolved when you're talking to companies and all that sort of stuff about sleep?
Yeah, that's interesting. So there's always been some fairly good research, at least for the last 10 or 15 years. I think there's been some pretty good research around just the basics in sleep hygiene, but the depth of research in the last couple of years is really expanded, and it's really opened up a lot around the way that sleep itself can not just restore our energy, you know, you have a good night's sleep and you wake up feeling better, but also our brains and our brain health. and our cognitive functioning. So there's a lot of really good research coming out from, especially one guy called Matthew Walker, who's done a lot of research, and you can definitely find his book or his podcast interviews and things to hear a lot more around the research that he's done. But just generally speaking, I think the fact that we understand the way that sleep, like I said, affects us physically and physiologically, but also in our workload, our work output. And there's some research to show that, for example, just having 6 hours sleep, or I think it was six and a half hours sleep, is the same as having a blood alcohol level above the legal limit. So, you know, you've got people, you've got the funny thing is, when I say this, when I'm hosting workshops that involve any conversation around sleep, I always ask my participants, like, how many hours sleep have you had? Mm-hmm. And I would say 70 to 80% of people are getting less than 7 hours of sleep a night, more like six, some five, and some 4 hours sleep. And then turning up to work with the equivalent, in that case, of, you know, blood alcohol level over the limit, which you wouldn't be inviting people to be having on the job. No. In a normal situation, right? So how is this happening? And so the errors, the same errors are being made. You know, we've got people behind cars with this level of sleep, and operating machinery and all this kind of thing. So it's really, really important that we talk about how we can help people to improve their sleep hygiene. On top of that, we have this issue with phones, and it's becoming more and more apparent. It's been 20 something years, I don't know, it's probably been even longer, that everybody's been carrying a phone in their pocket. But we're bringing in more and more apps, and people are finding it harder and harder. They're getting those dopamine hits from scrolling, and they're finding it harder and harder to switch off. So really helping people to understand what is actually happening to them when they are scrolling, when they're not getting enough sleep, what's actually happening to your brain, you know, and helping them to understand, well, here are some of the things that can work. These are some of the things I think we need to help people to understand, because it's really hard. It's similar to the social media ban that's come in for kids under 16 that's coming in here in Australia, because we kind of need that overarching kind of strategy to help people to really understand this is the effect it's having. It's that hard. It's so hard to get people to stop scrolling that we have to ban children from even being on the accounts, you know, and of course all the other horrible things that can happen to them on social media. So it's huge. It's a big thing. And I know plenty of people who just can't stop scrolling at nighttime, and the effect that that's having on their sleep is really profound. So yeah.
And looking ahead, what's something you're excited about in 2026, either personally or professionally?
I definitely am just looking forward to some of the organisations that I'm working with. I've got some good plans already for early next year and moving into the middle of the year. So there's some, like I said, the sleep consulting with the pain management program. There's the work that I'm doing with Medibank, and then there's a couple of other organisations that I'm going to be rolling out some wellbeing initiatives with. So those are some of the things I'm excited about. To be honest, I love that kind of work. It's so engaging for me that it's what kind of lights me up. So it really excites me that I've already got that all set up for next year.
No, that sounds amazing. Well, thank you so much, Ruth, for sharing your insights with us. Thank you to our audience for listening to this episode of Plant Grow Reap. We'll chat to you soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.